So do you know who killed your mother and father? Or your father and...
No, I really don't. I don't know who would want to.
Did you have anything to do with it?
No, I didn't.
Hi all, I'm Kevin, and thanks so much for stopping by. Here at Just Thought Lounge, we examine interesting cases that hopefully raise some thought-provoking questions. Today we're tackling a viewer recommendation, and we are very grateful to have had it suggested. This case is complex, it has some twists and turns, and it also has something that we gravitate towards here on JTL, which is loads to contemplate. So we're going back over 30 years for this one, but shockingly, it is still developing. Hearings are scheduled for early 2022. Without further delay, this is the tragic story of the Pelly family, Bob, Don, Janelle, and Jolene. It is also known as the Prom Night Murders. Early on a Sunday morning in the spring of 1989, the small community of Lakeville, Indiana was preparing for their regular church service. A young girl, about 9 years old, best friends with the pastor's daughter, runs down the street to the parsonage to let herself in for some breakfast, as she often did. That Sunday morning, however, unlike any other morning before it, the doors to the pastor's home were locked up. There was no movement inside, and no sign of her friend or the family. The church congregation had already assembled at the Olive Branch Church next door. This collection of people, waiting on their pastor, wandered over to check things out. Using the master key, they entered the home, and there they made a horrifying discovery. Pastor Bob, his wife Dawn, and two youngest girls, 6-year-old Jolene and 8-year-old Janelle, lay inside. When investigators arrived, they see an empty gun rack where the pastor's shotgun should be and note that not all family members were present. They quickly narrowed their focus on one of the surviving children that was away from the home that night. 17-year-old Jeff Pelly was at his high school prom the night before. Except Jeff hadn't been given permission to attend the prom that evening. His father, the pastor, had made that very clear.
Me and my father didn't get along sometimes. Sometimes I'd be really upset with him. But we always worked things out. I could sit back later and see where he was coming from.
It did get kind of rough for you as far as the him telling you he didn't want you to go to prom or at the after prom party or whatever?
It did. I was upset and I kept trying to talk him into it. And at first he kept saying no, and then he finally agreed to let me go.
On the day of the prom, Saturday, April 29th, 1989, Jeff worked the early morning shift at McDonald's. He washed his car and watched a baseball game on television. By late afternoon, Bob, Don, Jeff, and his two youngest stepsisters, Janelle and Jolene, were all at the parsonage. Jeff's third stepsister, 9-year-old Jessica, and his youngest sister, Jackie, were visiting friends for the weekend. Around 4:30 or 4:45, Kim Oldenburg, a family friend who had dated Jeff, stopped by with her mother and prom date to show the Pellys her dress. Kim reported feeling like there was tension at the house during her visit. Jeff was very quiet, she said. He was not yet dressed or ready for the prom that evening. Close to this time, at around 4:40 or 4:45, another friend, Matt Miller, dropped by the Pellys' home. Matt left after only a few minutes, however, when he realized that he had forgotten his date's corsage at his house. Kim and her mother ended up leaving the house around 5 p.m. 15 minutes later, Matt drove past the house again. He didn't stop this time, but he did notice that Jeff hadn't left yet because his Mustang was still sitting in the driveway. When Jeff did leave the house, he grabbed his tuxedo for the prom and a change of clothes for the next day. Exactly when he packed up the car and left is very contentious, but he was next seen at an Amoco gas station at 5:20. He had a bit of car trouble on his way to meet friends. It was just idling a bit faster than it should. At the station, he got the help that he needed to fix the Mustang. He also gave his date, Darla, a quick ring to let her know that he was running late. He arrived at another friend's home at 5:30 to meet Darla and changed into his prom night tuxedo. After the dance, Jeff changed out of his tuxedo at a friend's house and went to the after prom party at a local bowling alley. At the bowling alley, Jeff asked Kim Oldenburg if he could join the slumber party at her house that night. Kim agreed, and Jeff and Darla spent the night at Kim's house with several other friends. The Pelly household was a very active one. The home was open to the community, friends, and neighbors to drop by unannounced to chat, seek advice from the pastor, or for the neighborhood kids to have a snack and play. So it didn't take long for neighbors to see signs that something was amiss. Of course, they could have never guessed what had actually taken place inside. Bob and Don were expected at Crystal Easterday's home at 5:30 to see her dress. When they failed to arrive on time as planned, Crystal and her date thought they would just swing by the Pelly house on their way to dinner. they arrive at about 5:45. They noted that the family station wagon was in the drive, but not Jeff's Mustang. All of the doors were locked and the curtains closed. This struck Crystal as odd, as the family usually left everything open during the day. This unsettling feeling was echoed by other neighbors who noticed the lack of movement inside, which was extremely unusual for the family and the kids at that time of day. The neighbors directly next door called over at about 7 p.m. They needed Bob or Don to pop over to theirs and let their dog outside that day. They had no answer. The view from their window looked directly on the side of the Pelly's house. From there, they could see the basement lights on at 9:15, and then again noted it around midnight. It was notable because the young girls slept down there and were not often allowed to stay up so late. The Pellys also had left their dog chained up outside. The timeline of interactions and observations of the Pelly residents that evening formed the basis of the investigation by police. It also formed the foundation of the case against Jeff Pelly. Police concluded that the murders had to have taken place between 5 p.m. and 5:20 p.m. on that Saturday night, so who else could it have been? And Jeff was known to get into a bit of trouble. Just weeks before the murders, Jeff had been caught by state police for burglarizing a local home, a friend of his father's, in fact. This behavior did not sit well with the good pastor, his father, and Jeff was subsequently grounded, restricted from driving his Mustang, and told that he could attend the prom with his father as a chaperone, but he could not go to the dinner beforehand, he could not attend the party afterwards, nor could he go to the amusement park with his friends the next day. Jeff's previous encounters with the police led to another predictable consequence. He was known to the police as a troublemaker. The same detective that handled the burglary case, Mark Center, was sent to investigate his family's deaths a few weeks later. Detectives said that Jeff was angry that his father would not allow him to attend any or all of the prom night events, so he shot his father in the upstairs hallway. And then, having left three witnesses in the form of his stepmother and two little stepsisters, went into the basement where they would also be found the next day.
Investigators immediately focused on Jeff Pelly, Jessica's stepbrother, who had been grounded by his father.
He could not go to the prom without his dad taking him. He couldn't go to dinner before the prom. He couldn't go to the after prom. I believe he killed his family and then was able to go to the prom.
The investigators' theory was supported by further circumstantial evidence. They found no sign of forced entry to the house, though it was locked up, indicating that the perpetrator likely had a key. They also found a small load of clothes, including a pink and blue shirt and blue jeans, in the washing machine. These clothes matched those that Kim Oldenburg had seen Jeff wearing just before 5 p.m. on Saturday while she and her mom were at the house. A luminol test of the washing machine cylinder failed to determine whether it was reacting to blood or phosphates found in laundry detergents in 1989. Police also learned Bob Pelly kept a 20-gauge shotgun, the presumed murder weapon, on a gun rack in the master bedroom. Jessica, Jeff's remaining stepsister, would note that the gun was on the rack before she left for a friend's home that weekend. It was missing after the murders. No shell casings or the gun itself were ever found. What of Jeff's behavior? Was it possible to have committed the kind of act that Jeff was suspected of and then go out with his friends and act entirely normal? According to witnesses who were with him that night, that is exactly what he did. Having attended all of the prom-related events, police found Jeff the next day at Great America Park and took him back to Lakeville for questioning. Around 4:45 a.m. on Monday, May 1st, police conducted a videotaped interview of Jeff in the presence of his maternal grandparents who had arrived from their home in Kentucky.
I guess what we want to talk to you about is, when was the last time you were home?
At about 4:45. Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening.
Everybody was still home when you left, right? Was everybody there?
Dad and Don and Janelle and Jolene were there. Jessica was at a friend's house and Jackie was in Huntington.
When you were a Great American, that detective or police officer up there had you in the room and told your parents had been murdered, what was your reaction to that?
I was shocked. Started crying. I mean, it stunned me. I didn't know how it could happen. I don't know why it would happen.
Was there anybody in the family you really didn't get along with? How about your stepmother?
We didn't get along real well. I mean, we talked hi, bye type thing, but we never really talked to each other or anything. I mean, I didn't hate her or anything, but we tolerated each other.
about your stepsisters?
Which ones? All three of them. What about them?
Did you get along with them?
Oh, I got along with the girls great. I just love the girls.
Did you and your dad get in any arguments Saturday?
No, we had a real good day Saturday. We got along real well.
What do you mean you and your dad had a real good day?
Saturday, we didn't argue at all. He said that I'd been doing a pretty good job of shaping up and everything.
Jeff's version of events from the night before had him stopping briefly at one gas station, the Amoco, to fix his car and then proceeding to his friend's place to meet up. A few hours later, however, Jeff gave a second unrecorded statement. He again gave his version of the events, stating that he stopped at a Casey's gas station because of car trouble. By this time, the police had learned from Darla that Jeff had called her from an Amoco station. When questioned about the discrepancy, Jeff became nervous and upset. When questioned again, he said that he had stopped at the Casey's to buy a pop and proceeded to the Amoco. The detective told Jeff that he did not accept the story because pop was available at both stations. The detective then told Jeff that he believed Jeff was involved in the murders, and the car trouble was part of a way to account for a time gap. Jeff slumped down in his chair, lowered his head, covered his eyes, and asked whether he could see Darla that night, whether he would go to jail that night, and whether he would get the electric chair. Jeff also asked, if there were some things that led up to what happened, would it make a difference with what happened to him? Police examined Jeff for indications of bruising around the shoulder, which would have been common for someone firing a shotgun multiple times, but no bruising was visible. There was also no physical evidence directly connecting Jeff to the crimes. The case against him rested on the suggested warped motive, access to the presumed weapon, and a 20-minute window of time in which it is assumed that the crime took place. After assessing the investigation as a whole, the prosecutors in 1989 declined to press charges, and the case went cold for 13 years. Then in 2002, a new prosecutor took over the case. At this point, detectives went to visit Jeff's surviving stepsister, Jessica, who had started a new life for herself and now went by Jessie. Jessie was asked who she believed was responsible for the death of her parents and siblings. She had spent over a decade believing the answer had to be Bob, her stepfather. Detectives explained to her that no weapon was found near Bob at the scene, that it was simply impossible for him to have accomplished the crime on his own. So then she thought, well, the only other person it could have been was Jeff. In 2002, they decided to charge Jeff with 4 counts of homicide, despite not uncovering any new evidence in the intervening years. By this time, Jeff was married and had a son of his own, and had built a successful career as a computer consultant in Florida. He was arrested at Los Angeles International Airport on the way home from a business trip. The case went to trial in 2006. Prosecutors alleged Jeff shot his family members on the evening of the prom, disposed of the shotgun and shells, took a shower, put his clothes in the washer, and then left for the prom. The defense argued that there wasn't enough time to accomplish all of these tasks within the narrow window of time. They also said no one could commit such a gruesome attack and still act normal during the prom events, as his friends testified. The defense also questioned the decision by investigators not to look for fingerprints at the crime scene. Police officers testified during the trial that they didn't think they would find any usable prints, and they thought it would be a waste of time because Jeff was their main suspect. The jury deliberated for 25 hours, from a Wednesday afternoon through to late on the Friday evening. They returned a guilty verdict on all 4 counts. Jeff, now 34 years old, was sentenced to 160 years in prison. Jeff's defense team appealed the convictions. Initially, at least, they were successful. The convictions were actually overturned in April 2008, only to then be reinstated by the Indiana Supreme Court in 2009. In the same year, the Indiana Innocence Network adopted the case. They have been working tirelessly on developing new evidence in order to push for a new trial. Finally, in 2019, they began to get some traction. The defense claimed after the verdict that they overheard jurors saying, well, who else could it be? This is the same logic applied by Mark Center, the detective on the case. He was quoted years later saying, who else could have done it? Who else would have done it? Who else had the motive? Well, over 30 years later, Jeff's legal team is attempting to answer that exact question. They are doing so by delving deeper into the past of Pastor Bob. Bob Pelley had not been the pastor at the Olive Branch Church for very long, nor a pastor for very long. Bob married his first wife, Joy, in September 1970. They lived in a modest home in Kentucky, and at that time, Bob studied religious studies and computer science at college. After working for a time at a manufacturing company, Bob accepted a new opportunity as a supervisor with Landmark Banking Corporation in Florida. He was putting his computer skills to work, and it was seemingly quite lucrative. By 1980, the family had moved to a large home in Fort Myers and was prospering financially. They now also had two children, Jeff, of course, and his younger sister Jackie. In 1984, Joy was diagnosed with skin cancer and would pass away in February the next year. By November, Bob had remarried. Don Pelly's husband, Ed, had also died only months earlier, so the two decided to make a new start together and join their family, like in the Brady Bunch. Part of this new life was an abrupt move from Florida in 1986 to Lakeview, Indiana. This move also included a career change for Bob. No longer interested in corporate success, he accepted a position as a pastor at Olive Branch Church. The sudden move from their sprawling home in Florida to the cramped parsonage in Lakeview is indicative of what Jeff Pelly's defense team, over three decades later, suggests as an alternative theory for what happened on the prom night in 1989. New testimony suggests that Jeff's father was involved in some illegal financial dealings in Florida and became mixed up with some unsavory people, namely organized crime. Apparently, Landmark Banking Corporation had been under federal investigation for fraud and money laundering. Recent court filings by Jeff's defense team center around the testimony of a woman named Toni Beeler. Toni's company had been hired by the Olive Branch Church and was compiling a photographic directory. Toni came forward to police when she saw Jeff was charged with the murders because she spoke with Bob at the time and he was not keen to develop this directory. Toni says that she told investigators in 2003 about a conversation from years earlier in which Bob said he did not want his picture published because he had another life prior to becoming a minister. Toni believed that Bob was fearful of what would happen if his past caught up with him. Bob did not give Toni the details of this past life, but her statements support the theory that the family were victims of a criminal operation. Their deaths could have been retribution for illegal financial dealings undertaken by Bob when he worked at Landmark Bank. There's more to support this bizarre theory. Defense filings on behalf of Jeff also reference the unsolved murder of Bob Pelly's old business partner from Florida, a man named Clarence Eric Dawson. Clarence was killed in late 1988, only months before the prom night. He disappeared on the 9th of September after he left his Whiskey Creek home in South Fort Myers to meet with a potential investor. He was never seen again. Clarence left behind a wife and three children. He also left a series of very upset investors and piles of lawsuits from those who claimed that he scammed them and made off with millions. A few months later, about 4 miles east of Interstate 75, hunters found his body in a shallow grave entombed in concrete. He had been shot squarely once in the back of the head. No weapon was ever recovered and no arrests were ever made. Other business partners of his claimed he had associations with the Detroit mob. Authorities were never able to substantiate these claims. The now-retired detective assigned to the case, however, admits that his death had all the trademarks of a mob hit. What does all of this mean for Jeff's case, and does any of it begin to explain the tragedy of what happened to the Pelly family that night? Well, maybe. The hearing scheduled over several days in March 2022 will look at why Toni's testimony about Bob's past life and secrecy was kept out of his first trial. It's worth noting that this interview was recorded and in the trial documents at the time, but it is now missing. There are further accusations against the state. Prosecutors told jurors in the original trial that the jeans they located in the washing machine, that were assumed to be the same as those worn by Jeff when the shooting took place, were washed. However, initial police reports indicated the jeans were in fact dirty, and they were not found in the washing machine. This appears to be a convenient lie put forward to show an attempt to hide evidence of the crime. Furthermore, there are questions surrounding the time of death. The case made against Jeff largely rests on the timeline, the exact 20 minutes in which it could have taken place. There appears to be no coroner's report with an estimated time of death, and the autopsies were performed quite late without noting the details that would have established or confirmed the time of death around 5 p.m. as suggested. Is it then possible that the crime could have been committed later? Is it possible that neighbors' recollections of what was odd about the home that evening are memories constructed in retrospect based on what they now believe to have happened? Jesse says that the ongoing trial dates have created a never-ending nightmare. To come to terms with the trauma in her life, she has published a memoir co-written with a cousin that she reconnected with in later life. She says she still struggles as a survivor, but she is getting help and has loving and supportive friends and family around her. Jackie Pelley maintains unwavering support for her brother's innocence. She maintains the Justice for Jeff website, set up shortly after his convictions were reinstated. Jackie says her father always came across like a tough disciplinarian, but he never kept his foot down for too long. She says he almost always conceded to his children's pleas for leniency, just as she believes that he did for Jeff on prom night 1989. Thank you once again for joining me today. If you have any thoughts about this case, please do let me know in the comments below. My name is Kevin, this is Just Thought Lounge, and I'll see you in the next one.
Strong circumstantial case is never as good as a strong scientific case. I knew that she had killed Mike and Karen, and I did not know that we'd be able to prove it. We didn't have fingerprints, we didn't have DNA, and we didn't have it in terms of forensic science.